This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
It is my pleasure to welcome you to Chapter 2 of the 2014 Clark Kerr Lecture Series, being given by Simon Morgenson. I remind you once again that the Clark Kerr Lecture Series recognized Clark Kerr's various roles, including being Chancellor of the Berkeley campus, the very first one, including being President of the University of California at a particularly difficult and important period, and including all of his work with the Carnegie Commission and other Carnegie organizations. And so it is fitting that the lecture series is jointly sponsored by both the University of California Office of the President and the Carnegie Corporation of New York. I will introduce again Simon Morgenson, who many of you met 2 days ago as he gave the first of these lectures. He is a professor of international higher education at the Institute of Education, London, part of the University of London, and before that spent many years in Australia, primarily at the University of Melbourne, where he headed something with the interesting title of Center for Studies in Higher Education. So with that, Simon Morgenson.
Well, thank you again, Judd, and it's a pleasure to be here again. And thank you all for coming to the second lecture. In the first lecture, I reflected on Clark Kerr, on the master plan, on the uses of the university at some length, and on two other Californian scholars of higher education, Martin Trowe and Bob Clark. I discussed the three scholars in terms of what I call the Californian model of higher education. The Californian model is a higher education system that serves the state and its people, expands at need, combines access with excellence amid diverse provision, and is crowned by the large research multiversity with its many missions. Californian model is in some trouble in California, perhaps not the whole of the model, and perhaps not all of it in trouble in the same way. And I will open up further on that in Lecture 3 next week. But today I will talk about the passage of these great ideas beyond the United States amid the globalization of higher education and science. Concepts drawn from the Californian model, the master plan, and particularly Clark Kerr's multiversity, have become near universal, and practices around the world have become widely Californized. Maybe they'll make a television series about it one day. Though Californian ideas are articulated through divergent political cultures and educational structures. Today I will also discuss the global pluralization of knowledge power, the epochal return of East Asia to the front rank, and the potentials of this for American higher education. And I'll illustrate the argument with tables and graphs. It'll be a different presentation to the one last time. And I should say that if you become weary of tables and graphs in this presentation, my third lecture will revert back to the predominantly oral style. Global systems are changing higher education. I mean, these systems include world science, the accumulation and circulation of knowledge published in English, internet-mediated communications, global comparison and ranking of national systems and universities. The weight of these global systems in our affairs is increasing. I mean, more incrementally, so is global mobility. The number of students outside their country of citizenship increased from 1.3 million in 1990 to 4.5 million a generation later in 2012. That's a substantial increase. That's multiplied three times in a generation. Foreign students are relatively marginal in the United States, just 4% of the total higher education enrollment, but they increased from 408,000 in 1991 to 820,000 in 2012-13. Internet penetration has reached 3 billion across the world, more than 40% of the world's population, 85% of the North American population. Nations and universities can no longer isolate themselves. And this has changed the strategic conditions in which they operate. It's not changed the essential project of the nation state, which was already, prior to the internet, global in character. Philip Cianni calls it the global competition state. Nation-states around the world watch closely what other nations are doing, especially in military technology and industrial innovation. There's an ongoing process of emulation and borrowing, of imitation combined with strategic initiative, as each nation strives to secure a competitive advantage. Since Hiroshima, and more so since Silicon Valley, nations see higher education and science as primary arenas of global competition. At the same time, universities and science are also primary mediums for global cooperation, often between the parties that are also competing with each other. In this period, I would argue that there are two worldwide tendencies at work. One is the rapid growth of participation in higher education. The other is the growth and spread of research science. These tendencies are driven partly by nation states and economies, especially in relation to science, and partly driven by middle class aspirations for social position via education, as I discussed last time. First, the worldwide pattern of participation. Now, the change in the last 15 years is quite astonishing. Here we see the Martin Trowe factor at work. The tendency of middle class social demand for higher education to expand from mass levels of participation continually until near universal participation is reached. And look at the uniformity of the trend line in those different country bars. The gross tertiary enrolment ratio, or GTER, refers to people enrolled at tertiary level, including two-year programs, as a proportion of the school leaver age group. The GTER is larger than age group participation. I mean, it includes mature age and foreign students, but it's the best number for trends and comparisons, so I'm using it here. In 1975, the GTER in the United States was 51%, 1975, 51%, much the highest level in the world at the time. One other nation was above 30%, and that was Soviet Russia at 43%. Fast forward to 2012, 2 years ago. There were 54 national education systems with a GTER above 51%. In 2012, the United States was number three in the world with a GTER of 94%. Remember, it includes mature age and foreign students, 94%. Behind South Korea and Greece, and a whisker in front of Finland. A lot of other countries are over 85%. The gap between the US and the other high participation nations is closing. Well, that in itself is not bad, given that the US's participation is pretty high. But I want to emphasise the broader pattern. There is a worldwide tendency towards high participation systems in higher education. It extends beyond the OECD countries in the graph to middle-income countries and emerging states. In fact, almost every nation with a per capita income of over $3,000 per head per year, 1/20th of the level in this country. In almost every country in that category, participation is increasing and usually at a rapid rate. And everywhere, when participation in higher education reaches Trowe's universal level of 50%, it keeps on increasing towards an absolutely universal level. This tendency towards high participation systems, without using that term, was discussed in a 2005 article in American Sociological Review by Evan Schofer and John Meyer. And they state that the older notion of higher education as constituting a closed society and occupational system has been replaced by an open system picture of education as constituting useful human resources for unlimited progress. In other words, a pool of labour capacity which can be called on for a whole range of economic and social tasks. Pure Californian model thinking, I would have thought. Schofer and Meyer also link patterns of expansion to factors such as democratisation, human rights and global linkages. And I think this is more tendentious. On my reading of it, this great growth of higher education extends to multi-party states like Norway or Korea, single-party states like Russia or Singapore, and dynastic regimes like China. Everywhere, states once restricted growth and feared over-education. Everywhere, states now accommodate the insistent middle-class demand for higher education, though in many countries, states ask those same middle classes to bear an increasing proportion of the cost, knowing that those middle classes have no choice but to participate and to pay an increasing share of the cost. States have learned that lesson. They will not reverse it. At the worldwide level, the GTR jumped from 14% in 1992 to 32% in 2012, and most of the growth occurred in the last decade. The GTR now exceeds 50% across the whole of Western and Eastern Europe, North America, much of Latin America, and East Asia except for China. Between 1992 and 2012, it increased markedly in each world region except Central Asia, as you can see from the graph. It remained low in South Asia, but in India, it rose from 6 to 25%. So the dynamic of rapid growth has taken hold in the most important South Asian country. Participation in higher education is growing faster than national economies, as you can see from this graph. And remember that GDP per capita in China is increasing rapidly, but the rate of growth of participation far outstrips it now. It correlates more than with economic growth, it correlates with urbanisation and the growth of numbers of people in the urban middle classes. With the spread of rapid urbanisation to India, China and Indonesia, three of the four largest nations, the other being the United States, the total number of higher educated people is advancing on a monumental scale. China's participation rate is at 30%, heading towards an official target of 40% in 2020, though it's uneven by region. I mean, in Beijing and Shanghai, the GTR exceeds 60%. Most of the expansion in China is in the second and third tier institutions, including sub-degree colleges. Until recently, China was following the community college template in developing mass higher education, doing so explicitly. However, in June this year, China announced 600 higher education institutions would be remade as vocational institutes, establishing a dual-track higher education sector parallel to the German and Korean systems, where the vocational sector feeds into high-skill export manufacturing industry. And in those countries, of course, the second sector, the technical vocational sector, is in relatively high social standing. Not quite real parity of esteem with the research universities, but not that far short, and certainly higher than it is in many other countries. This is what China wants to do. China's first vocational Gaokao end-of-school examination was conducted in June this year. Now, in the map of growing participation, there are gaps in South Asia, Pakistan and Bangladesh. Pakistan's increasing at the same rate as India, but from a very low base, and still only about 14%. And in pockets of Latin America and the Caribbean. But the major gap is sub-Saharan Africa. The GTR was still only 8% in 2012. Private and public incomes are low. Middle-class demand is limited. And in unstable states, the long-term construction of higher education and science systems is a low priority. This gap in Africa has global consequences. Family size and birth rate are correlated to education levels, especially to the education of women. When enough women reach tertiary education, growth of population slows sharply. The world population projections have just been revised. Now, for 20 years, we thought the global population was going to peak at 9 billion people in 2050. The revised projections state that population will keep on increasing, reaching 11 billion in 2100, with no peak in sight. So it will keep increasing. While fertility rates have come down in most countries, it is not the case in sub-Saharan Africa. Its population will grow over this period from 1 billion people today to more than 4 billion in 2100, in 85 years. In Nigeria alone, growth will be from 200 million to 900 million. The average Nigerian woman has 6 children. About 30% of women in Nigeria do not have primary education. So that this high birth rate will drive this population increase unless and until high participation higher education can be established. In the rollout of the Californian ideal across the world, there is much at stake. So far I've talked about participation as if it is a uniform quality across each student place. And of course, as you know, it is not. In every nation, student places have unequal value in terms of selectivity, cost, the unequal status of institutions, and the unequal firepower of diplomas. All higher education sectors are stratified between prestigious institutions, mostly research-intensive universities, sometimes select teaching-focused colleges, and institutions relatively easy to access whose role is largely confined to teaching. Between lie a layer of middle institutions that combine aspects of Martin Tro's elite and mass higher education. Size of the middle group and the vertical stretch between institutions, the steepness of the hierarchy, if you like, varies greatly by country. Structures vary. Some countries like UK and Australia run a unitary system in which all institutions have the same nominal role in teaching, research and service, but they actually vary sharply in their research output, their student selectivity and their prestige. Some countries like Germany and the Netherlands maintain binary systems with two different mission-based groupings of institutions. A third group of countries, such as the United States and China, use classifications to sort large national systems. Many systems have a different shape to the master plan, especially in Western Europe. However, in nearly all systems, elite research-intensive universities are formally or informally demarcated from other institutions, and in many systems, the expansion of participation is concentrated in a large lower-tier sector. In China, Russia, and the United States, that lower tier is predominantly public, with some private sector enrolments. In Korea, India, and Brazil, it's largely private. Again, the world is following, though, the outline of the California model. Except those nations that sustain unitary higher education systems with parity of esteem across all institutions, the Nordic countries. These nations offer all citizens high-quality higher education as a matter of right, a more completely public policy than the Californian model. The form of stratification, though, is a key issue. As we'll discuss further in the next lecture, across the world, elite research-intensive universities are travelling well. They have their problems, but they're travelling well on the whole compared to other institutions. But mass higher education generally is not. Mass provision is fragmented between struggling large public institutions with high workloads, you will recognise the type, small, often solipsistic private colleges, shoestring for-profits, and technology without teaching. It seems to be becoming an increasingly popular alternative for some people. Mass higher education is undervalued, under-resourced, and often low quality because it doesn't have the sort of symbolic power of the brand of that the selective institutions have. Quality assurance techniques are installed almost everywhere. But while QA encourages internal institutional reflexivities, it has failed to generate broad-based momentum for measurable quality improvement. It's mostly used to control faculty and to augment marketing. It's a way of saying we are going well even if we're not. I will now turn to the second worldwide Californian tendency, the spread of science in the research university. Now, all nation states now want capability in science and technology, though not all can pay for it. Nations need an indigenous science infrastructure and trade personnel, just as they need clean water, stable governance, and a globally viable finance system. They need to be able to interpret, understand, and apply the world science system. To do this, they must connect to it actively. They need their own trained personnel capable of creating research, because that's how you connect actively to the world system. Nations that lack indigenous research capacity will find themselves in a position of continuing dependence and they will be locked out of knowledge-intensive production of their own. The growth in research science is almost as spectacular as the growth in student participation, though not yet as universal. Science has moved from the margins of state building, something that only the leading global players in North America, Europe, UK and Japan could afford, to part of the normal business of established and emerging states. Again, there is no end in sight to the process of growth. In policy, the spread of science takes the comparative form of an arms race in innovation. Comparisons of industry innovation are elusive, and governments don't direct business activity directly in many countries anyway. So policymakers focus on global science in universities. And in a curious kind of way, this has brought the published science basic research back onto the agenda and tipped the balance back away from a focus on applied research, which was perhaps becoming extreme in many countries. Global research rankings are the device that governments use to compare national performance and signify their global competitive position. In 1995, 37 nations published over 1,000 research papers in the science journals, a proxy indicator for indigenous capacity in global science. By 2011, there were 51 such nations. The new science nations included Croatia, Serbia, which has got a per capita income of about 11,000 US, well below the global average of 17,000, but has a ranked top 500 research university, the university in Belgrade. Slovenia, Chile, which is doing very well, Malaysia, which is, after all the 20 years of talk about the knowledge economy, has finally got two universities in the top 500. Thailand, which is surprising indigenous strength, and Tunisia. The fastest growing science system, though, is Iran, where since 1995, the number of journal papers has increased by 25% a year, mostly in the strategic physical sciences. Other nations where output growth exceeds 9% a year include China, momentously, 17% a year, South Korea, Turkey, Portugal, Singapore, and Brazil. All governments now want universities that can, quote from Philip Allpack, participate effectively in the global knowledge network on an equal basis with the top academic institutions in the world. This sustains the desire for the so-called world-class university, conventionally defined by position in the global university rankings. Now, there's an obvious fallacy with this basis of policymaking. I mean, rankings signify relative, not absolute, performance. If everyone improves in the same proportion, your ranked position is unchanged, but you do have more capacity, and that you should be able to recognise that. But you don't if your indicator is a ranking position. All the same, for most policymakers and university leaders, it's enough to be in the Shanghai Jiao Tong University Academic Ranking of World Universities, the ARWU, or perhaps the Times Higher Education Ranking. When science is valued in terms of the global competition state, then science power equals competitive position. Many governments and universities now set strategic goals based on reaching the world's top 500 or top 100 or top 50 research universities. Most of them, in the medium term anyway, are failing, but they're still setting themselves these goals. France, China, Korea, Japan, Saudi Arabia are amongst the countries that have invested significant amounts of money to augment their leading research universities or to secure mergers, as in France, to combine measured outputs or to create new institutions to try and push their way into the rankings. For example, Saudi Arabia has pushed four universities into the top 500 in the ARWU by playing the indicators. I mean, a large number of foreign researchers are hired for part of the year so they can enter the high citations and publication statistics. And also, Saudi Arabia has joined to that a very high investment. So the King Abdullah University of Science and Technology was founded only 5 years ago in 2009 at a cost of more than $10 billion. US, and it's already found its way into the rankings. American universities are indifferent, of course, to their global research ranking. I mean, the fact that Berkeley is ranked currently five in the world will be something probably that will be news to many people here. US news is the arbiter of domestic standing. I mean, everyone sees US higher education as the only world series that matters. But it's not so in other nations, which compare their progress against American strength, and they also take Europe and Asia seriously. Now, the Shanghai ARWU, and to a lesser extent the Times Higher Ranking, which uses a multi-indicator measure that claims to cover teaching resources and internationalisation as well as research, stratify the sector on a global basis. The research ranking by Leiden University's Centre for Science and Technology Studies is the best ranking in methodological terms and informs serious research policy and strategy, although it's not part of the public discussion very much. Research by Ellen Hazelcorn from Ireland shows that global rankings shape the choices of international students closely and influence the decisions and judgments of governments, foundations and private investors in higher education, and also they influence the decisions about mobility made by faculty and they influence the strategic decisions of university executives. Overwhelmingly, research university presidents in most countries want to improve their rank position by installing strategies to increase measured research outputs, high citation papers, publications in Nature and Science, which figure in the Jiao Tong, as you can see, and other indicators that feed into rankings. These university leaders normalise their resource allocations and normalise their faculty activity according to the content of the global rankings, according to these indicators. So these indicators have become very important in shaping the sector. The normative content of the rankings is basically the globalised multiversity, the large English-speaking science university. If you are a university president, it helps to be comprehensive in the sciences, especially engineering and medicine, which are great publication citation engines, to publish in global journals, to concentrate resources on large research teams, not spread the money more thinly across a range of teaching research disciplines, to favour research against teaching, especially undergraduate teaching, to shift resources out of arts, humanities, most of the social sciences and professional disciplines. Note that these are problems that Clark Kerr talked about, as I said 2 days ago. And, of course, if you're in a non-English-speaking country, it pays to encourage English language publishing in the relevant disciplines and reduce publishing in national languages if that's going to help you do that. To make short-term gains, it's better to recruit global talent, not nurture local talent, to recruit established faculty, not emerging faculty, and to sharply differentiate pay in favour of faculty stars in ranked fields. However, the English speaking science university template is in tension with other norms in higher education. And take the Latin American national universities, the gigantic ones, Sao Paulo in Brazil, UBA in Argentina, UNAM in Mexico. Now, these are much larger than the multiversity model, and they have a broader scope. UNAM has over 300,000 students. No one's quite sure how many. It's a very large number. Dozens of sites, carries out a quarter of all the research in Mexico still. It's a major access provider, and it sustains much of Mexico City's cultural life. These social roles hurt UNAM in the rankings, which penalised universities with many teaching-only and service staff. Given UNAM's flagship role in Mexico, a ranking outside the world top 100 hurts it in the eyes of the public and government. Rankings have created a no-win for UNAM. Now, should it dramatically reduce national mission to meet the rankings template? If it narrows mission, it loses national funding and perhaps it loses status in the country. If it does not narrow its mission, it loses its ranking position and that loses status, and this can also trigger budget cuts. And what happens to the extensive Spanish language scholarship in the humanities and social sciences, which is often very impressive and important? It's doubly excluded by language and by discipline. All else equal, global competition regulated by ranking tends to reduce diversity in knowledge, ideas, and cultural forms. National systems of higher education have developed technical vocational universities, liberal arts colleges, and discipline specialist institutions in business studies, medicine, film and television, music, visual arts, and so on. All of these fall outside the global rankings. My own institution in London is merging with University College London simply to be part of a globally ranked university, a specialist education institute, no matter how strong in the UK and world context, and it is ranked number one in the world at the moment, is simply cannot in the long term sustain its position in isolation from the ranked university sector. Over time, such institutions have a reduced capacity to attract money and attract high-quality faculty and doctoral students. LSE will eventually be forced to merge as well. Despite the English language bias in the rankings, because of the spread of science, the lists of top research universities are becoming more plural. Numbers from Taiwan, Korea, Malaysia, Brazil, and Chile have increased. Iran, Egypt, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia have entered the top 500. Amongst the countries that have lifted research performance in the last 15 years, though, the standouts are East Asian science and higher education. China, Hong Kong, SAR, Taiwan and South Korea. The countries and systems that, together with Singapore and Southeast Asia, which shares this share a cultural heritage of classical Chinese civilization. In these systems, the quantity and quality of science and the number of research universities are improving with extraordinary rapidity. This follows the accelerated development of science and higher education in Japan in the 1960s and 1970s. In the 2004 Shanghai AIWU ranking, there were three universities from East Asia, other than Japan, in the top 200. There were none from China. In the 2014 ranking, 10 years later, there were 12 East Asian universities in the top 200, including six from China: Tsinghua, Peking U, Shanghai Jiao Tong, Zhejiang, Fudan, and the University of Science and Technology, the Academy University. And there were also two from Hong Kong SAR as well. Now, these systems have internationalised their research universities using strategies such as benchmarking their universities and their disciplines against American, particularly American, also British or West European comparators, by offering incentives to faculty to publish in English, and enticing back the national research diaspora, principally from positions and doctorates in the United States. In 2004, there were eight Chinese universities in the top 500. In 2014, there were 32, 10 years later. This reflects a great increase in the number of published journal papers in English. English language competence is much higher amongst masters and doctoral students than amongst faculty over 40 or 45. In internationalising, the stronger Chinese research universities have become bilingual. Faculty in, say, China or Korea know much more about US research universities and what they do than US faculty know about China and Korea and what they do. And these universities have joined their internationalisation strategies to growing in levels of investment in capacity. The Sino-East Asian systems invest in R&D at a similar rate to the most research-intensive West European systems, such as Finland, Denmark and so on, Sweden. In 2011, South Korea invested 4.03% of GDP in R&D. That was second in the world after Israel in the proportion of GDP devoted to R&D. Proportion is also very high in Japan and fairly high in Taiwan, as you can see. Now, there are time lags between investments in research, greater scientific output, more citations and better rankings. I mean, today's pluralisation of the top 500 reflects investments of a decade ago, around about 2000-2005 period. Today's new investments will show in stronger rankings a decade hence. In 15 years' time, there will be many Chinese universities in the top 200. And universities from China, Singapore, Taiwan and Korea will be pushing towards the world's top 50 and perhaps 40. In some research rankings, the National University of Singapore is in the top 30 already. East Asia is becoming the third great region for research. This one jumps out for me, after North America and Western Europe, UK. By 2014, East Asia will have passed North America in aggregate terms. These figures are for 2011, and it's nearly there already. In China, R&D investment is increasing by 0.1% a year, 0.1% of GDP a year, and is currently just below 2%. The target is 2.5. That's not far short of the US level of 2.88. The policy target will place China's, I mean, given that China's GDP is about to pass the United States, if its R&D effort as a percentage of GDP is close to the United States, its R&D is going to be in aggregate terms close to that of the United States. But if it keeps increasing, it'll go past, obviously. Only about 8% of China's R&D money, though, goes to the universities, which is about half the rate in the United States, at 15%. Most of China's R&D goes to the state enterprises. Most of Chinese economic activity seems to be concentrated in the state enterprises. But because of the overall growth of R&D, the trickle down to the universities is increasing significantly. Science output in the C9 and the 985 group in the research university sector is expanding rapidly. The star indicates the approximate level of China's research paper output this year in 2014. You can see that it won't be too long before it catches the American level. This is talking about quantity of published science papers. The number of papers is also growing rapidly in South Korea, Taiwan and Singapore, though not quite as rapidly as China. Korea is the second, really, in terms of dynamism. It's clear, though, whatever, that in future, much of our science is going to come from East Asia. And this is basic science we're talking about here. Basic and strategic basic, the sort of science which is published in journals. There's a lot of other science being produced which is not published in journals. The total output of this group of countries now exceeds that of North America. This is all on the quantity side of the agenda. We should talk about the quality side. It's often argued that, and with some justification in the past, that while research quantity is expanding in East Asia rapidly, the quality is not there. And perhaps the quality will never be there. Well, the second proposition, I believe the jury is out. I'm not at all persuaded either way on that. But I would say that the quality gap is closing anyway. Average citation rates per paper in East Asia are significantly lower than in the English-speaking countries and in Western Europe, but they are improving. Average citations are high in Singapore. Singapore has got the research settings of a strong UK university, basically. And they're also high in Hong Kong SAR. It's got beautiful citation levels. But China's the interesting one, of course, and the slide shows the improvement in engineering in China over that 10-year period. That big jump in the percentage of papers ranked in the top 1% in the world from 2.5 to 12.2 in 10 years. That's pretty rapid improvement in quality. Similar things have happened in chemistry, and it's probably worth talking about chemistry. In 2000, China published 3.7% of world papers in chemistry. in 2012, 16.9%. So 3.7 to 16.9 in 12 years. Now, China now publishes more papers in chemistry than the United States. More strikingly, in 2000, it published only 0.6% of the chemistry papers ranked in the top 1% by citation rate. But now, in 2012, it published 16.3% of those top 1% papers. Half as many as the United States, like in engineering, but even more so. Very rapid improvement. Now, in computing, China now publishes more of the top 1% papers than the United States. That's the only discipline where China has actually gone past the United States in the volume of high citation science. But clearly, gaps are closing fast in all those physical science areas. Now, it's interesting to see that China, Taiwan, South Korea, Japan, and to some extent Singapore, have concentrated research in the physical sciences and related applied fields like engineering, computing, and materials. In Korea and Japan, this supports advanced manufacturing. In China, China emphasises research related to accelerated modernisation. I mean, energy, urbanisation, construction, transport and communications. The most recent development is the surge of papers in bioscience, but it's from a low base. The humanities and the social sciences have low status, despite the elite universities that emphasise liberal studies, such as Peking U and Fudan. There's no clear-cut economic rationale for investment, and those disciplines contribute little to ranking performance. So, as in some other countries, they're being weakened, not strengthened, in this environment. Yet, the social sciences and humanities nurture nationally distinctive values, and in China may yet become more strongly part of the agenda for that reason. East Asian higher education and science are underpinned by the world's highest performing school systems. And the OECD's Programme for International Student Assessment, PISA, which compares the learning achievements of 15-year-olds, the seven top systems in mathematics are all from East Asia. Even Vietnam, with a per capita income of 10% of the United States in 2013, does better than the United States and the UK in all three PISA disciplines. And Vietnam shares that strong Confucian culture of education in the home because it was occupied by China for 1,000 years. The 30 million population Shanghai region has a long lead over every other education system in the world. As far as I can see, these results are genuine. I mean, Shanghai manages its PISA results no more than any other education system, and they all do, really. Those that don't do usually dip in the PISA results and then manage better next time. I had that conversation in Ireland after the second last set of PISA results came out, and they said, oh, we put all our attention on national tests and we forgot to focus on managing PISA, and next time we'll do better, and they did. But, you know, Shanghai does the same. But Shanghai uses PISA strategically. I mean, I was there a week after these last results came out and heard a paper from someone who's working in the ministry, the provincial ministry, in relation to the PISA results. And they'd isolated the subcategories below the PISA indicators and the areas where they weren't number one in the world. They were focusing on those and they were determined to lift those to number one in the world. They're on rote learning, they had lower rote learning figures than the world average. So, you know, you're not really dealing with a traditional East Asian rote learning-based system here. You are dealing with systems now in Korea and China which have been heavily influenced by Western progressivism, which emphasise creativity, which talk about student-directed learning, which are changing the way classrooms work against the resistance of the profession. You know, but you are looking at education systems which in many ways at school level are similar to Western systems, except that people work much harder. But even in the poorest and lowest achieving provinces in China, the 2012 PISA results were just below the world average. And the strongest American state, Massachusetts, was outside the world top 10. So you can see that the gap is quite considerable. The comparison is probably the best comparison is between Shanghai and Hong Kong and Singapore, you know, this sort of strong urbanised, smallest urbanised regions, all predominantly middle class, all with globalised economies. Not only are average PISA scores very high in the Sinic systems, the size of the high-achieving group is very large. And there are few students in the lowest-achieving PISA categories. I mean, Singapore, for example, 40% of students are at levels 5 or 6 in PISA math compared to 9% in the United States. Only 8% of Singapore students are in the bottom group in PISA, compared to 26% in the United States. The United States is a little bit above the world average. Sinex societies are not egalitarian, but student learning achievement is near universal. There doesn't seem to be an equity excellence trade-off, and good teachers are put in low-performing schools to bring them up, as in Finland. Chinese students work relatively hard at higher education stage also. Just before this lecture, I was handed first results from a survey comparing student time use in Shanghai and New York. Now, both of the groups were business studies students. They were about the same age and roughly the same levels. Both groups of students did paid work for about 18 to 19 hours a week. And they watched movies via TV or the internet for about 9 hours a week. So they were the same on those indicators. 72% of the Chinese students and 73% of the Americans played video games for an average of 6 hours a week. So again, same pattern. Up to this point, identity, the Chinese students spent more time on social networking than the Americans. However, the main difference between the two groups was the time spent on intellectually productive activities, studying and reading for leisure. Chinese students read for leisure, including newspapers, for an average of about 10 hours a week. The Americans, 4 hours a week. There was about 5% of the Chinese students read for less than an hour a week. About 25% of the American students read for less than an hour a week. And when you come to study, as you'd expect, Chinese students study for 22 hours a week and the Americans for 9 hours a week. Now, you've seen the much larger study of this, which indicated that the remaining time was being partly used for social engagement purposes. And presumably there's more social engagement in the American sector than there is in China. Now, that of course, is not necessarily good for China, but you can see the difference in terms of intellectual formation. Now, what are the conditions and drivers of this educational dynamism and the rapid development of science in these countries? Economic growth and national investment have been essential conditions. The underlying conditions, I would argue, are twofold. One is the long and deep family tradition of Confucian self-cultivation through education. You have the deepest, strongest tradition of education in the world as a result of that. The other is state strategy. East Asian states, whether multi-party, single-party or dynastic, exhibit a remarkable capacity to mobilise resources and effort to achieve policy goals in education and science. This capacity derives from the East Asian or Sinic form of state, which has a very long history stretching back to the Qin and Han dynasties 2,200 years ago. East Asian countries do not sustain the same state society and state market tensions that are typical of the English-speaking world, with our limited liberal state tradition, the Adam Smith and John Locke state, and our recurring anti-statism, which becomes almost the main driver of our politics, so that we equate freedom with absence of state control. And it's not like that in East Asia. That's not the central driver of politics. States in East Asia are characterised by strong continuity and a long-term view. Government posts enjoy high social status. People, the best graduates want to work for government, not necessarily to go to their professions or business. Though the Sinic state does not administer society in detail, its supreme vis-a-vis the economy. Politics is always in command. Korea, Taiwan, Japan, China, it's the same. And the state intervenes at will when it wants to. The present government in China is best understood not in terms of communism versus capitalism. I mean, clearly China does both. It's got a communist political system and a capitalist economy. But it's better understood as another dynasty in China's long history, behaving like the other dynasties did. Although this is a relatively strong dynasty, maybe only the Tang was as successful as this dynasty at a global level. It's as if in Europe, the Roman Empire, instead of breaking up in the West in the 5th century AD, had returned and again with new developments and in different guises for the last 2,000 years. And we can trace a direct line of causality in its systems of governance and the assumptions in that govern the political culture and the relationship between the people and the state. At best, East Asian states can mobilise a high level of support in the population for their initiatives. One example is China's policy on energy. China is radically remaking its pattern of energy use. Coal use will peak next year and then decline. Low emissions energy sources such as hydro, wind, nuclear, solar and gas are growing by 4% a year. The governments of the United States and Australia, where I come from, have so far been unable to confront the oil and coal companies successfully to shift the balance decisively towards renewables. The Germans have been able to do it, but we can't. And certainly the Chinese, in their way, are going to do it as well. For us, the freedom of trade is a higher principle than maintaining the common ecosystem. The state in China intervenes in energy policy, like education policy, because energy is seen as strategically significant. And as I said, it's able routinely to secure support for such interventions. Effective East Asian states poses questions about university autonomy and academic freedom. Are Sinic political and educational cultures as friendly to disciplinary creativity as Europe and North America? It's not a simple question to answer. Universities are seen as part of the state. Devolution is normal within the comprehensive Sinic state, including devolution to universities. But the central state retains the scope, as I said, to intervene at will. That's not compatible with routine independence. In China, government appoints the university leaders, appoints the president and the party secretary, the two top positions, but by different wings of Chinese government make those appointments, which, interestingly. In Singapore and Japan, the president is selected by the governing council of the university. So this notion of autonomous control of leadership selection has become established in Singapore, which is a one-party state. But in those systems, normal operations depend on a high degree of harmony between university and the state. I mean, if the university president of the National University of Singapore wanted to run a policy substantially at variance with what the state wanted to do, he or she wouldn't last very long. Perhaps the greater problem in China, though, than the capacity of the state to intervene through the leadership selection process and through pressure placed on individual leaders, the greater problem is the chronic state administrative interference in peer decisions about research funding, particularly in the life sciences. This has been a major problem, a major weakness, I think, of the Chinese research system. China is not like Soviet Russia, though. It's not like Soviet Russia was in higher education and science, you know, keeping a sealed environment, translating all the foreign English language and German stuff into Russian and then having the conversation internally and sending nothing back out to the rest of the world. That's not what happens with China. The universities are open and they learn freely from abroad and they talk freely to people abroad. There's much feisty political debate inside Chinese universities. It's really interesting to go to conferences and see the amount of criticism of government policy by people from within the party often, and often they criticise the party officials in the university to their face. It's in some ways, that people are more direct about those kinds of political discussions than they are in Western universities. But that's all behind closed doors because the university is part of the state. It's not in public. Those kinds of debates are not conducted in civil society. And as you know, faculty who challenge the party state from outside in the civil sphere can be very savagely repressed. In Chinese tradition, scholars challenge the regime only when they believe it has lost the mandate of heaven, when it's lost the right to rule. So it's a great step to take. And in some ways an irreversible one. So this is not a tradition which allows for routine, easy criticism where it doesn't really matter what you say because it doesn't change anything anyway. This is a culture where criticism is meant to be weighty and have an effect. So when it occurs, it has consequences. Sinic norms of academic freedom are distinct from Anglo-American norms, and that's why it's difficult to make the judgment about academic freedom, because which basis of judgment do you use? Which tradition do you hold accountable at that point? In China, there's more emphasis on the positive responsibility of faculty and less on freedom from constraint or freedom from interference. I mean, no one in either tradition likes being told what to do, but in China, the role is seen in a more positive way rather than freedom from constraint. And, I mean, some Chinese faculty will argue that that is a greater empowerment. And in some respects, the position of the professor is more held in higher esteem in China. But correspondingly, there's less room to engage in freewheeling criticism. And that role, of course, has great value in a political and intellectual culture. So faculty agency per se is not necessarily inhibited, but it takes rather different forms. And there are problems, I think, particularly in the social sciences, where the substance of the social sciences comes, you know, so close to the interests of government. On the other hand, as in the US, I mean, much always bubbling is always bubbling up from below. And I think the growth of higher education in the country is creating conditions for liberalisation. And one of the reasons why higher education has been encouraged in its growth in China is because the liberals within the political apparatus see it as a means for slowly liberalising the country. What they all want to avoid is the rapid process of liberalisation and opening up that occurred in Russia and then the collapse of everything. That's what they want to avoid. But no one's quite sure where liberalisation is going, how far it can go, and what the end of the road, if there is one, is. We do not really know whether East Asian states will decisively limit their academic creativity by the nature of themselves as states. I think this issue has got much further to run, and I'm keeping an open mind on the question of the model and its capacities. So the higher education world is becoming more like California, and this is facilitating the spread of power beyond California and the United States, and beyond the West European systems that are also lifting in this period. China, Taiwan, Korea, and Singapore do not do America as well as America does, but they are improving. East Asian systems also have their own traditions and their own assets. These systems are a new hybrid of East and West. This is not Western science in an Eastern form. This is something new. It's something combining these traditions, and we're not quite sure where it's going to end up yet. I think as they become stronger, these systems are going to show their cultural roots more directly. Their roots in Chinese civilization will become more obvious. We're in the stage of high imitation. I suspect as China makes it, it starts to become a little bit more relaxed about its own specific character and less inclined to drive itself through internationalization. Maybe some turning inward might occur at that point. Until recently, the United States published more than half the world's high citation journal papers. I mean, it still houses 60% of the top 50 research universities. Phenomenal. The United States remains exceptionally strong and the leading power in higher education and science, though I think its absolute dominance is going to ebb. A more diverse higher education world is not a bad thing. What are the implications for higher education in the United States of the rise of China? Well, first, geopolitical strategy. America-China is now the pivotal relationship on which the world turns. The two need to find a way to share power, first in Asia, which is the issue at the moment, and then globally. And this will not be easy to do. Present military tensions are worrying, but it's essential to find a constructive way forward. It's not so much a question of striking a bargain that reflects the new balance of power as what shape the future will take. If there's to be a stable world society and polity capable of handling the big challenges ahead, it will probably be a hybrid between Anglo-American traditions and Sinic traditions in political culture and social organisations. In all this, universities in the two countries are crucial in drawing together policymakers and intellectuals, combining projects, sustaining long-term cross-border conversations, and developing bilingual concepts and ideas. The University of California campuses have long fostered constructive relations in East Asia. There's a deeper understanding of East Asia here in Berkeley, for example, than there is in most parts of the American higher education system. Clark Kerr sat on the council of the Chinese University of Hong Kong from its inception. Augmenting productive relations between America and China is a vital contribution that the UC campuses can make to the national and global public good. It's hard to think of any public service that's more important than contributing constructively to the evolution of US-China relations in the world. In research, the interests of both systems lie in synergistic partnerships, and I think this is the position which is being taken by research strategists in this country now. On the Chinese side, this facilitates access to the principal and emerging scientific domains. On the American side, the synergistic partnership approach provides an economical means of continuing leadership and tapping into offshore talent and ideas. Links with Korea and Taiwan and Singapore and Japan are important because they provide alternative ways into East Asia and another vantage point on China. And they've all got their concerns about the developing hegemon in their own region. And those concerns are, understandable and they allow for a certain skepticism, a certain distance from China. Second, internationalisation at home. Well, English will remain the global language of science and maybe of business and politics. The growing strength of non-English speaking nations in economic matters and communications and in higher education means that multilingual capacity is becoming more important. And when you're dealing with large global middle classes that speak languages other than English, you know, you could be pretty sure that those languages are not going to disappear and that they'll be, for business and other reasons, important to understand. Whereas in 2030, 9% of all internet users had English as their first language. By 2013, that proportion had dropped to 29%, and the Chinese proportion had jumped from 9 to 23. Spanish speakers rose from 5 to 8%. Another area for development, as you know, is student mobility. If American students are to travel to Asia in sufficient numbers, it'll be necessary to subsidise the process until critical mass is reached. Inward movement remains relatively low, although in California it's higher than it is in the rest of the country. Foreign students are 17% of all higher education students in the UK. They're 18% of all higher education students onshore in Australia, but only 4% in the United States higher education system. Although international diversity has doubled this level at Berkeley, for example. Very, very high at USC. It's the highest, I think, in the country at about 8,500 foreign students. In UK and Australia, foreign students are a self-financed add-on to the normal enrolment, and there's no perceived conflict between giving a place to a foreign student who's paying their way in full and the local students, and there's no reduction in the number of local places provided. But offshore engagement is more than a matter of temporary people exchange. To lift relations with China and East Asia to a new level, it'd be necessary to devise strategies that are transformative at both ends. Many leading American universities are now active in China. There's a lot of very good things being done in China. The US is much more active in China than the UK, where I'm now based, I notice. Now, but only one university, in my view, has developed a clearly game-changing project, and that's NYU. NYU students spend at least a semester at each of NYU's three campus sites, New York, in Abu Dhabi, and in Shanghai. NYU Shanghai is in partnership with East China Normal. That's a top 40 university, and the first president of NYU Shanghai is the previous president of East China Normal. So this is serious. It's been put right in at the top of the system. NYU Shanghai brings together elite formation in China and the US. It embeds NYU in the Chinese higher education system. New York thinking is now an active part of the evolution of higher education within China. It's part of the internal conversation. It's part of the party state, because that's what it means being put into that level of engagement. Not indirectly, through the screen of China's internationalisation strategy, but it's now a direct participant in the system. Equally importantly, there's deep learning on the American side. Faculty administrators will live in China for long periods. They'll develop language. Students from NYU New York and NYU Abu Dhabi will spend long enough in Shanghai to develop language and knowledge of Chinese culture. My gut feeling tells me that in engaging with China, it's necessary to go out ahead of government and public opinion, and perhaps local faculty opinion as well, or some of it, as NYU had to do, and build something new that will change both American higher education and China. And having those New York voices in China has long-term implications for the Chinese political culture. Global exchange and reciprocity that respects diversity and hybridity is a global public good. This is the kind of deep engagement fostered by the National University of Singapore. Very impressive global strategy. I think it's the best in the world at the moment. NUS has an outstanding perspective. It understands what's happening in higher education across the world. It's got custom-built links with every higher education region and most principal, the principal institution or the second institution in most leading higher education countries. In 2008, I conducted interviews at a Midwestern American Public Research University. One of my questions was, are there any universities in the world outside the US which provide useful models or programs from which American universities can learn? Now, most interviewees had no enthusiasm for the terms of the question. They did not name any foreign universities. Instead, they provided a long list of American universities that were doing great things, and they were doing great things. They were good lists. But this showed both the strength and the weakness, I think, of the approach to internationalisation. Great capacity to share and learn nationally. You know, this is what the national market has done. It's brought, it's given people a tremendous awareness of who's doing what and a willingness to learn across the country, constantly edging forward to try and do better than others or work with those who are doing well. But indifference to other cultures and the notion that someone else could do something really well is just outside the ken. But there were three interviewees, actually, at this Midwestern Public University who were very enthusiastic about the National University of Singapore, and they were negotiating a partnership with NUS, and they knew what it was doing. So that's my conclusion. The multiversity is becoming the global multiversity in many countries, if not most countries, if not almost all. The global has become a core mission in many countries. In the United States, the process lags somewhat and it could be quickened. Rather than separating international activity from local activity, protecting them from each other perhaps, we need to find ways of more constructively aligning them. Constructive internationalisation that opens new roads forward and encourages the movement of ideas and talent is in the interests of students and taxpayers in California. Nevertheless, we have work to do both in explaining this successfully to people who do not connect internationally and in making these synergies, these local global synergies happen. I think that's the nub of the political problem here, to get that right. In the first lecture, I discussed Clark Kerr's big ideas driving the public mission of the multiversity in the California model in the 1960s, universal access and progress towards scientific research. Now, both of these big ideas have become a bit more ambiguous and contested, particularly access. But both access and progress through science remain central and agreed objectives of higher education. But I think in addition to access and progress through science, and these ideas have gone around the world, we now have internationalisation as well. We now have the global multiversity. And that's essentially what everyone is doing outside the United States. They're now in this third big idea as well. And they're relating their internationalisation idea to their work in research and access. I think to bring in the global multiversity into Clark Kerr's vision is the sort of transformation to a higher level of synthesis, embracing all of the interests that he himself used to practice. In lifting the mission of the university to the global level, UC can move beyond the bounds of the 1960 Master Plan, seize the times, and again exercise national and global leadership. In this, all regions of the world are important, but a central part of any internationalisation strategy in this period, given its geopolitical character, must be the intensification of links with East Asia as the emerging player and the development of constructive American-China relations in an era where they could be either constructive or not. California harbours the world's greatest resources in higher education. This institution that I'm in today, this week, is at the peak of that set of resources. And it's been the global thought leader in the sector since 1960. In a global relational environment, all countries are now interdependent and leaders have responsibilities. If the Californian model becomes thoroughly transformed into the globally engaged Californian model, bringing California to the world and the world to California, everyone will benefit. Next week, in the final lecture at Berkeley, I'll return to the Master Plan and the multiversity and consider where the public mission of higher education might go from here. I'll suggest two ways forward and discuss system shape, participation lags, and related issues. Thank you very much for being here, and I hope you'll come again next Tuesday.
Hi, thank you for your lecture. That was quite interesting. I do have a question. You mentioned the evolution of the global multiversity, but I do have a question regarding especially the mobility of students and how that factors into the California public mission. Mm-hmm. From what I understand, the UC system, perhaps even the entire California higher education model, is quite interested in developing relationships with, say, higher education in China. But in the sense that, I believe the system sees China as a very fecund source of tuition revenue against the backdrop of shrinking domestic funding sources. And so, you mentioned that only 4% of total student enrollment in the U.S. it comes from abroad. But if you look specifically even here at Berkeley, 15% of the undergraduate population comes from abroad, the majority of whom are from China. And you can see that across many of the UC campuses, even where I did my PhD at UCLA, the numbers are quite similar. So I'm just wondering if you could comment on what I see as the tension between, increasing intercultural understanding through these rapid demographic shifts of bringing in international students, which is on one hand quite exciting, but on the other hand, I see a tension in also serving the public mission of or the dedication to the local community here in California. I mean, obviously, UC Berkeley is a public institution, and so I'm just wondering, perhaps this. Foreshadows your third talk, so I apologize if I'm being a bit preemptive here.
No, not at all. I mean, and of course, that tension is very real and very important to discuss, and I knew we'd need to discuss it after I spoke. It's interesting, isn't it, because UK and Australia are not that dissimilar, but perhaps the intensity of competition for the best institutions is not quite as great, except at Oxford and Cambridge, perhaps. But in both those countries, they went to a commercial model of international education, full fee recovery model, in fact, a surplus-generating model. In Australia, the business students pay about three times what the nominal local cost of a place is. So there's a substantial surplus that comes from each of those places. Now, what's happened in both those countries is that there's been a vast expansion in numbers of international students. I mean, at Melbourne, where I come from, this is the leading research university in Australia and 44th from the world. There are 12,500 on-site, full-time international students, the largest number in the world in any university, and that's not creating any apparent tension. It's very hard to get into the university domestically because it's been an add-on. It's been understood as an add-on right from the beginning, and there was no reduction in the number of places available to domestic students when the number of international students started to increase. Instead, there were new facilities, new buildings, new services attached to those new growing intakes. I think it would be not so easy here. I mean, we know that. And we know that every time there's a move to increase numbers of international students, there's a debate about it. So it's clearly people don't perceive it as a zero, they don't perceive it as an add-on, they perceive it as zero sum. So there's a lot of work to be done to change that kind of perception. But so I'd go about it carefully. I think that it's quite legitimate to see international activity as a source of revenue, but if you see it as the primary reason you're internationally engaged, it won't go so well. And that's been the Australian experience. It's been overly financially focused, and you're missing the cultural and intellectual benefits that should be flowing from it. But it's legitimate, it seems to me, to seek to recover its cost and to use it as a source of overall revenues. But, I mean, I think that the sensitivity here is about the first degree. I mean, so if you stack in too many numbers in the UC system at first degree level, and already, as you say, there's substantial numbers, and I'm aware of the figures and aware of the UCLA situation, for example, if you put in too many more, then there is going to be that kind of backlash. Even though the taxpayer is not paying much of the cost anymore, they still see it as their sector and they have a right to enter, and they do. So, or at least they have a right to aspire. And we know the sensitivity around issues related to access and the right to enter. So I think graduate level should be the primary focus. I think if you look at where the English language countries and especially the United States might fit into the world division of labour globally, then their role is as great graduate schools. I mean, graduate education and doctoral research in the United States is going to be way out ahead of way out ahead of East Asia for a very long time. Whereas at first degree level, the elite institutions are pretty strong players in their own countries. But for a lot of students, a first degree in an elite institution followed by a graduate school in the United States would be a pretty attractive proposition. Whereas there's been a tendency up to now for the intake of the Chinese students to be those who didn't get into Beidou or Tsinghua, and to come to an elite institution in the United States has been the second choice. I think what you'd rather see long term is the development of the United States as the graduate school. I realise that the Chinese institutions are developing their own graduate schools, and they should, but I do think that the United States perhaps has a bigger role there, and that, of course, is where the cultural, the foreign policy benefits and all the other, the intellectual benefits of engagement with international education are maximised, because you get the best quality people at graduate stage, you hold them for longer, they do great work, and some of them stay, and they become long-term partners and friends if they don't. So I think that's maybe the way to go, and maybe if there are revenue benefits, maybe to make some of them there. And that's generally what the British have tended to do. There's what they call taught postgraduate has become a huge foreign student area. And they make a lot of their money too out of international education through master's programs.
As always, lots of stuff to think about. Here's a point. Clark Kerr thought the model of the multiversity was Harvard. Mm-hmm. And the Godkin mm-hmm. lectures are given at Harvard. He wasn't flattering Harvard. He really did think that Harvard had jumped out ahead. And this was a private university and not a public university. Mm-hmm. And it had set the model for this new type of university, which you've now indicated has gone global. Would you like to comment on mm-hmm. the private mm-hmm. university initiative? We're in a public institution. We're constantly thinking about that. Mm-hmm. But the private universities always set the pace. Mm-hmm. And on these various rankings, you know who comes up first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the private universities are engaged really well in China. I mean, that law school initiative, Yale and Peking University, for example, very interesting, a joint campus. Harvard's all over China. There's lots of Stanford activity. Peking University's got a major Stanford-related center, for example. There's something specific about the American private universities at the peak. They're like arms of the state, you know, in a sense. They do the work of America abroad. Without being told what to do, remarkable, and it's a very effective operation because they're able to operate with such freedom, and I think and take initiatives, and they have deep pockets, and they can afford to do things, but they behave like public universities do in a lot of other countries. It's funny because when you look at the global environment, often the public universities become private in the way they operate, but curiously, you see in the private sector, the elite private sector in the United States, institutions behaving non-commercially, and in many respects taking on goals and objectives which go beyond just narrow self-interest. I mean, they're clearly establishing broad highways which will have a long-term effect on the country and have flow-ons that go far beyond the institution alone. But by doing so, they're positioning themselves, of course, right at the peak of worldwide higher education and maintaining a strong role. And I think the MOOCs were very interesting in that regard because, you know, MOOCs are an important part of the mix in the future, I think, although they're not going to replace elite education at all. They provide a form of elite education which is enormously accessible, high-quality content, high-quality professors, high-quality transmission. And there again, I think the top universities, Stanford and Harvard and MIT in particular, have positioned themselves almost like great film companies to influence the cultural environment of the whole world for quite a long time to come. So there's more at work here than what people would conventionally understand under the heading private. This is a much larger thing. And I think we lack in the political culture, we lack the terminology which allows us to talk about this kind of civil society institution which behaves in a broad-based public and private way simultaneously. And I think when Kerr was saying the multiversity was private and public and something else as well, he was trying to get at that. And I think we need the language to explain that.
He did end up thinking it was a hybrid. The university was a hybrid.
Yeah.
We can talk later about some other
things. And I think the public university is. It's just as well. It's just, I mean, one of the issues that arises now in the current environment, you know, is the degree to which the UC system campuses might pursue their own interests in a standalone way. Almost as private institutions in a market. But the mixes are different, and there are I think your history really determines a lot of this. Public and private sector is part of that history, and we know what you can do is always depend on what you have done in the past and where you're going, your trajectory.
You haven't said much about academic freedom on the worldwide higher education scene. We have many groups from China who come to Berkeley. They want to know all about how we do admissions, how we do technology transfer, how we organize, how we do our faculty review. The groups from China are not all that interested in academic freedom, and I wondered if you had any comments about that.
Well, as I said, I think that this is a very important discussion about in relation to China and in China, and it's a subtle and complex problem. and one which we need to enter into at a level, at that level of complexity, to be able to make headway on. I guess the point I was making in the lecture was that I think that there are intersections between an American notion of academic freedom and a Chinese notion, and there are also differences. And we need to, and neither, I would criticise neither tradition, because it's not like not the same as the other. I mean, I think that in some ways, I like the Chinese notion about responsibility, about, you know, faculty having a shaping role in society on behalf of the common good, if you like, on behalf of the state. And I think when we talk about the public mission, we are actually saying that. You know, we're connecting to that. But what they do is they put the state in there as well, more explicitly, whereas we see the state and public mission often as something, you know, something quite different, or at least at askance to each other. And maybe there's a tension there. So that's the difference. So, but I like that positive responsibility. I think we should take responsibility for the good of our society and seek to advance its health and its interests. So that's good. And we, our professors should be respected for what they know and what they do. And that's good as well. But I think the constraints on people's freedom to intellectual freedom, as they appear more often in that system, in that tradition. And no one likes it very much in China. But I think that creating a liberal conversation in the disciplines is really crucial. So the way I'd approach, you know, for intellectual development, so the way I'd approach that in dealing with our colleagues from China would be to say, you know, what kind of networks, what kind of discussions do you have in the disciplinary way? How do you make decisions on research priorities? You know, how do you determine the content of teaching programs? You know, whose judgments are respected? What happens? How's it shaped? And you'll find that the state is involved in curriculum development, for example, in a way which it isn't in some other traditions. But then, you know, it's a complex problem because we use standardised testing in a way which is very normalising in our educational traditions, more at school level than at higher education level. So there's a lot of intersections and there's a lot of differences, but it's important to free up that, free people from the fear of speaking out, but free up, above all, free up the disciplines. The question of what public intellectuals do is another question. That's a question of democratic rights. And that's a question of how civil society develops. And that seems to me is the nub of the matter in China. You know, where civil society goes long term. I mean, it has to develop because it's you cannot have a modern society based with consumers, with middle class people, with education, with broad-based entrepreneurship and professional development. You can't have those things without a civil society. The state can't. And these states don't want to run everything directly anyway. So, you know, they need a civil society in a sense. But how does China find its way to a civil society and maintain a stable polity? That's its problem. And that's not an easy problem, but maybe we can help with that. But, you know, we've got problems in our polity too. So, you know, we're not altogether clean.
Well, I think one thing you might be overlooking when you're thinking about the output of American universities is immigration, because many, many of the scientists mm-hmm. who are producing those publications are the children of immigrants who came to this country. Mm-hmm. United States has benefited passively. Our strategy of internationalization has perhaps been passive because we get so many immigrants from other countries, especially in the university. World events such as World War II or the collapse of the Soviet Union brought many, many scientists to the United States at the upper level of the academy. And then the children of immigrants populate our classrooms and then go on to become scientists themselves. So it's not just bringing students in from other countries, which is internationalizing in the academy of the United States. It's what we call diversity in California. So I'm not sure how much that influence flows back to the countries of origin, but I think that might be worthy of study, especially in the University of California today.
Oh, yeah. And I think this is a great strength of American society is its immigration-based character and its openness to continuing immigration. And this is, I mean, I come from a similar society, smaller version of it, the settler state. And you know, which is immigration dependent. In fact, the Australian economy is driven by two things: mining and immigration. If the commodity prices go down, or the immigration numbers get cut because of immigration resistance, which flares up every 10 or 15 years, then the economic settings start to look poor. So I know about the importance of immigration economically, but I think it's a great asset culturally and socially. And you know, the energy that comes from first and second generation immigrants is tremendous. And It's powered a lot of institutional development in my country. I mean, I think that one of the interesting things about immigration and continuing relations with home countries is that the degree of overlap or the degree of connection between the first-generation immigrant populations and the home countries at a strategic level, for example, in relation to higher education, not as great as it should be. That is, people from China don't carry much of the relationship between US universities and China. People from India don't carry much of the relationship between US universities and India. You know, you don't, the local populations don't act in any sense as a support or a condition or an intermediary or maybe there's some way we can make those connections more effectively, because the universities are so diverse, as you say. And I think the composition of the non-academic staffing is often very important. People who are appointed to positions which play instrumental roles in relation to study abroad in those kinds of areas, you know, and there it's really good to have a diverse group there that really does have the languages and understanding, and that can make a lot of difference in opening up a broader highway and sustainable relationships and so on, establishing goodwill at the other end in particular.
Thanks for your lecture. You just mentioned the students in Shanghai get high score in OECD's examination. But in China, people always think the students' score are too high to damage the innovation. So what do you think? Do you think it's a challenge for the U.S. education?
I think it's somewhere between. I mean, you probably know the Amy Chua book, you know, the Tiger Mum book. I actually reviewed that book in length, and then I spoke to her at some length. And it was tongue-in-cheek, but she, of course, hit on a very important phenomenon and described it very well. When I go to China, my colleagues in China all say the same thing. They say, you know, we're not Tiger Mums or we're not Tiger Dads. Our child has music. You know, our child has drama, has friends. We have vacations. We make our child go to bed, you know, that she or he gets some sleep, has a normal, balanced life. But all these children do really well, you know, in the examinations anyway. And I think it's something about expectations there, probably in academic families. It's not just about hard work. But I suspect that what's impressive about Chinese society is that the commitment to learning runs right through every family, including very poor families. And I think that in our traditions, we have to work very hard to get some of our poor families engaged in the educational process, to give them aspiration, to give them a sense that it's worthwhile. You know, that it's, whereas in China, it's like it's almost as part of you. You know, you have to focus on schooling and education. It's just so important, as you know, in a sense, it's a part of your parenting that you know you do this for your child, and your child does this for you. Works hard and so on. So it's there's something about that orientation which is, as an educator, I find quite impressive and attractive. But I mean, I think the overwork is nuts, and you know the degree of intensity of competition at upper secondary is nuts. And I think the long term, we all need to move away from selection at age 16, 17, which is a very fraught time, immediately post puberty. A lot of other development is going on with human beings. We ought to be able to do our key selection later. And probably at first degree, at the end of first degree stage, is where we should be becoming instrumental about where people are going to be heading longer term. And perhaps we put too much pressure on elite selection at the point of entry into college. And I think, you know, this is the East Asian system is going to find this hard because they don't have strong graduate school approaches, and they've got, you know, they make this selection at the end of school, and then the children tend to coast a bit after that. So it's going to be a big change to try and shift things up the age structure. But I think the long term with education is always to lift the age level at which general education is occurring and before selection occurs. So we now need to try and push through, if we can, to push through to social selection, occupational selection, after the first degree stage.
With that, thank you very much to our speaker, and a reminder to everyone that you can come here next Tuesday afternoon at 4 p.m., same place, for the bonfire of the publics, which surely will be interesting. Thank you, sir.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.